Okay, my name is Barry Kornblau. I am the rabbi of the Young Israel of Hollis Hills, Windsor Park in Bayside, Queens. And I am also the Director of Operations and Committees at the Rabbinical Council of America. And it's my great honor to be asked by Torah in Motion to address all of you this evening regarding matters pertaining to this week's Torah reading, the Parsha. And I'd like to thank you, of course, for being here. Without students, no one can teach, and without being able to teach, we teachers don't know as much as we otherwise would. Tonight, the topic that I would like to explore is the evolution, the crescendo, the presentation of the mitzvah of Shabbat as it appears in the Chumash, and more broadly in the entire Tanakh. The mitzvah of Shabbat is unusual among the many mitzvot of the Torah in that it appears multiple times throughout the Chumash, and it appears elsewhere in the Tanakh as well. This isn't true for many, many other mitzvot. It's not true for the mitzvah of getting married. It's not true for the mitzvah for the prohibition of wearing shatnez, wool and linen together. And many, many other mitzvot appear at tops once or twice in the Chumash. Shabbat is unique in that it appears over and over again. And so it's my intent, my thesis this evening, that the staged presentation, the sequenced presentation of the mitzvah of Shabbat and Chumash has a message to teach us just by the manner in which the Chumash presents it. And so we're going to have a wide-ranging Chumash study tonight. We're going to spend a bit more time than usual focused on Parsha Bishalach, this week's Parsha. But we're going to touch on many other sources as well, and that's why I encourage everyone to have in front of them an actual Chumash or Tanakh, preferably Hebrew English, as you have, in order to get the most possible out of my presentation. Additionally, the style of my presentation for this evening is going to basically disregard a large number of familiar midrashim. Very familiar midrashim, which talk about the avot, the forefathers of our people, observing the Torah before it was given, and the like. We're going to disregard all of those right now, and we're going to try to just address the text of the Bible, of the Tanakh, as it presents the mitzvah of Shabbat on its own, without reference to many other extraneous sources. I don't mean, chas v'shalom, to denigrate any midrashic sources, but I think that the Tanakh itself speaks to us loudly and clearly enough about its own ideas that we can, for now, try to hone in and just listen to those ideas alone. So, I'd like to posit that we're going to see the mitzvah of Shabbat, as I said, in many places, in many different contexts, with many different ideas around it. And I'd like to go through them one at a time and see how the mitzvah develops. Let's begin then at the very beginning of the Chumash in Parshat Bereshit. We're in the book of Genesis, chapter 2, verse 1. And here, pardon me, we have a description of the creation of the world. 6 days have gone by. The entire physical universe has been created, culminating at the end of the sixth day with the creation of the first man and the first woman. At that point, we kick in with a description of the seventh day of creation. And the Chumash tells us, "Vayichulu Hashem al ha'aretz v'chol tzva'am." This is the text which we recite on Friday night for Kiddush, that the heavens and their hosts were all completed at that point. And on the seventh day, God completed all of his malacha, all of his labor, so to speak, which he did in creating the world. Vayishbod bayom hashvi'i. God rested on the seventh day, Mikol Malachto Asher Asah, from all of the labor which he had done. And his reaction to that is, Vayivarech Elohim et Yom Hashvi'i, that God blesses the seventh day, V'yikadesh Oto, and he sanctifies it. For it was on that day that he Shavat Mikol Malachto Asher Bara Elohim La'asot. It was on that day that he ceased from all of the malacha which he had done in creating it. There are a number of key words and ideas here which are going to echo throughout the other appearances of the mitzvah of Shabbat. I just want to highlight them very quickly. First, we have words like Shabbat, or Shabbat itself. Shabbat is not quite called Shabbat here, it's just a day on which Hashem Shabbat, which he rested, but the day does not have a name other than the seventh day. And there are other important words too. Barich, Hashem blessed the seventh day. V'yikadesh, he sanctified the seventh day. We have the word la'asot, the very last word of verse 2-3 in the book of Genesis, is to do. The commentators puzzle over what it means, but for right now it's good enough to mention that it's simply there. We have a constant repetition of the word malacha. The malacha which Hashem did, the malacha which Hashem did, the malacha which Hashem did. three different times in three verses we have a reference to that idea, and malacha, of course, labor, is something which is quite familiar to us from the laws of Shabbat itself. So those are some of the key words and some of the key ideas. And the context in which we're operating here, of course, is the creation of the world. Although the day is not named, it clearly has a very dramatic significance here. Man has been created, and the sanctified and blessed seventh day has been set aside by God's rest, the significance of which we don't fully understand. But although man has been created and so has the seventh day, there's no connection that the Chumash makes between the seventh day and the man and the woman who have been created. We just know that they're both there, but we don't know what the connection between them might be. So that's the information, which the Chumash presents us with at the first presentation of the Mitzvah of Shabbat. It's quite obvious that coming at the end of this very dramatic creation story, that Shabbat is going to have some tremendous cosmic significance. It's going to be a very intense, important day. It's the culmination of everything. But we don't know how that's going to play out, really, other than latently. All we have is basic information here. After that, the Chumash itself is silent about the institution of Shabbat. It doesn't talk about it anymore. As I said, many Midrashim talk about it throughout the book of Bereshit. And indeed, Midrashim begin to speak about it again in our Parsha. In our Parsha, in Parsha Bishalach, in the book of Exodus, at chapter 15, towards the end, the Jews have been redeemed from the Egyptian servitude. They have been taken across the sea. They've been led in song by Miriam and by Moshe. And they are now traveling along for 3 days. They don't have any water. And Hashem brings them to a place called Marah, where they are given some laws. That's what the Chumash says at chapter 15, verse 25, that they were given some laws. So Chazal are of the opinion, and you can't see this in the text of the Chumash itself, that one of the laws that was given there was Shabbat. But aside from that, we don't really see any other sign of Shabbat in the Chumash at all. Shabbat proper begins, the story of it begins in chapter 16. And the presentation of this second presentation of the mitzvah of Shabbat appears in the context of the story of the man, of the manna, of the heavenly bread which Hashem provides to the Jewish people at this point in their history. And it's worth slowing down here. First of all, it's this week's parsha, but also it's a long presentation, and there's much to be taken out of it. So let's slow down and look at the text here together. We are in chapter 16 of the book of Exodus, Sefer Shemot, and at the first verse we read that they have come to an encampment on the B'chamisha Asar Yom L'Chodesh Hasheni, on the 15th day of the second month of their departure from Mitzrayim, from Egypt. And so this band of ex-slaves, they are used to no rest, They have been given a remarkable display of God's power in their departure from Egypt, but they are schlepping now through the desert. They are having frustrations suitably about water and food supply, and it's been a month, so they're kind of getting used to the routine a little bit, but they're not exactly sure what is before them, what their future excuse me, holds. And they begin to complain, and they start saying in verse 3, you know, we remember the good old days when we used to sit al sir habasar ba'achlein alechem lasova, when we used to sit by the flesh pots of Egypt, and we used to have lechem lasova, we used to have bread to a full sense of satiation and being full. And so they're remembering, they're imagining really, the good times which they never really had in Egypt, and they complain to Moshe. Moshe, continuing along, in verse 4, is addressed by Hashem. In verse 4 we read, Vayomer Adonai el Moshe, Hashem speaks to Moshe, and he tells Moshe, and Moshe alone, that he's going to provide lechem min hashamayim. He's going to provide heavenly bread. Bread is going to come down from the heavens, and at which point the people will go out and gather it, devar yom biyomo, one day at a time they're going to collect the manna from heaven, one day and the next day and the next day. And at that point, Hashem will be able to see, anasenu, leman anasenu hayelech, hayelech betorati imlo, whether or not the Jewish people will actually follow in the laws of Hashem. That is the first piece of information, excuse me, and that has nothing to do with Shabbat. At verse 5, Hashem tells Moshe one additional fact, which is that on the sixth day, the Jewish people are to vehechinu et asher yaviu, that they shall prepare that which they bring in. Not 100% clear what that means. Oh, now we know what it means. What it means is that the Jews are going to have a double portion of manna which falls to them on the sixth day compared to what normally falls to them on the other days. Moshe is told all of this information. He shares it with Aaron. And in verse 6, we now hear that Moshe and Aaron are taking the information that they were given and sharing it with the people. So in verse 6 we read, Vayomer Moshe v'Aaron el kol b'nei Yisrael. Moshe and Aaron turn to the people and they say, what do they tell them? They tell them that there's going to be, that Hashem has heard their complaints, and what you're going to see is that there's going to be food which comes down for you. And continuing along, picking up at verse 11 and forward, there's much details that are provided about the exact manner in which the manna is going to be provided, and that is given at some length. At that point, the people do what they're supposed to do. They're hard at work following Moshe's instructions. They collect the manna. They're surprised to discover that no matter how much they collect, a little bit or a lot, they always have exactly enough for one day, enough for each person in their household, exactly enough for one day. If they keep any over extra, it spoils. It's obviously a very unusual sort of food. What is interesting, though, is that Moshe and Aaron were told two separate facts. The first is the unique style of divine sustenance coming out of the heavens. That's issue number one, and that they share with the people. But the second piece of information, namely the fact that there will be a double portion coming on Erev Shabbat on the sixth day, that they never share with the people. And so it's hardly surprising that as we arrive at verse 22, that when finally the first Friday comes after the manna starts falling, we read as follows. Vayihi, Vayom HaShishi, on that first Friday of manna falling, we hear, Laktu Lachem Mishneh, the people gathered a double portion of the divine heavenly bread, Shneha Omer Lachad, double the amount that they had been receiving previously. And all of the elders of the congregation come to Moshe, and they tell him, hey, look at that. We just got twice as much as we got on the other days. On the other days, whether we took a lot or a little, we only got exactly the right amount. But here we are on this day, and no matter whether we take a lot or a little, we get exactly twice as much as we got the other days. Hey, Moses, holy Moses, Moshe, what's going on? They're totally surprised. They're startled. What could be going on? Now, the reason why they're startled is because, according to the simple reading of the Chumash, Moshe never told them anything about this. And there's an opinion in the Chazal that he forgot to tell them, or maybe he intentionally didn't forget, didn't tell them, or maybe he thought that Hashem didn't want them to know. Whatever exactly the story is, the bottom line is, they didn't know. And so that's why, at verse 23, excuse me, the Chumash tells us how Moshe replied to the people. Moshe turns to them and says, Hu asher dibir Hashem. This is exactly in keeping with what Hashem told me, namely, Shabbaton Shabbat Kodesh Lashem Machar. It's going to be a Sabbath of Sabbaths tomorrow for the Lord. Et asher tofu ifu. That's what you're going to, which you ordinarily would have cooked tomorrow, which you cooked last Saturday and the Saturday before and the Saturday before. You have to stop doing that now. Instead, you have to bake today for what you're going to have tomorrow. Et asher tivashlu bashelu. That's what you're going to need to, which you ordinarily would have cooked on Saturday, like you did last week and the week before. That you're going to have to do today. Vet kol ha'odef, and every leftover portion of the manna, which normally would be spoiling, I'm instructing you to the contrary. Hanichu lachem l'mishmeret at haboker. You can keep that overnight, and I'm promising you it'll be in good condition, it'll be preserved and fresh, it'll be shamor mishmeret, it'll be in good shape in the morning. There's no reason to be concerned that it's going to become foul like it did on previous occasions. And so the Jews, startled, follow the instructions, and in verse 24, that's what we read. Just like Moshe commanded, that's what they do, and lo and behold, the food did not spoil. The fact that Hashem singled out in verse 23 the idea of cooking and baking in advance, that's not a random detail that he was sharing with them. The only other holiday that the Jews know about, according to the simple reading of the Chumash, again without Midrashim or anything, at this point is the holiday of Pesach. They were instructed about they lived through the first Pesach, the first Passover in Egypt, and additionally, they were given a clear indication that this was going to be a permanent holiday, and they were told that in general they couldn't do malacha, they couldn't do prohibited work, but they were allowed to cook and do things that are ochel nefesh, that have to do with eating. And so the Chumash here, Moshe tells them that this is a Shabbat Shabbaton, this is an even more holy day than the previous Yom Tov, which you know. It is a doubly, it is a extra day of rest, and not only do you have to observe the rules of Yom Tov, a holiday rules, but you can't even cook and bake, which on Yom Tov, on Pesach, you were allowed to do. And so that's why these details are singled out here, because it's new information. Oh, this is an even more holy day. It's even more restricted and more prohibited than the previous days. Continuing along with the story, morning comes in verse 24, as I was saying, and it doesn't spoil. They wake up, and unlike the other days, the manna, the man, has not spoiled. And at that point in the morning of that first Shabbos, when the Jews are observing this kind of beginnings of Shabbos, Moshe turns to the people and says, Ichluhu hayom, ki Shabbat hayom l'Hashem, hayom lo timtza'uhu basadeh, timtza'uhu basadeh. Moses turns to the people and says, eat it, eat the manna which you've collected today. After all, today is the Sabbath for God. Today, you won't find any of this manna out in the fields. Whatever you already have, it's not going to spoil. Eat it today. Chazal are of the opinion that this verse is the foundation of the mitzvah of Shalosh Sudot B'Shabbat, to eat three times on the Sabbath day. The Talmud records one opinion that those three meals have to be eaten on the day of Shabbos, meaning from the morning until the sun goes down, until the end of Shabbos. And that makes sense according to the simple reading of the text here. You have to eat it today, the Chumash says. And so Chazal understood that meant three separate eatings that needed to be done today. And the strict opinion in the Talmud is that all those have to be done during the day proper, during the sunlight hours. Happily, we don't follow that opinion. We follow the opinion that it can be done any time during the 24 or 25 hour period of Shabbat. But this thrice repetition of the word Hayom in the context of eating the manna is the source for the mitzvah of three meals on Shabbat. When we have our three meals on Shabbat, we're apparently supposed to remember the exalted status of the food that we're eating. It's holy bread. We're supposed to remind ourselves of God sustaining us throughout the week in general, and on Shabbat in particular. And specifically, all the special ceremony that we give to the making of the motzi with two loaves of bread, the double portion of manna, is reflected here in this text. I hope that this is familiar to you from your life, and the taste of that Shabbos bread is going to be in your mouth very soon tomorrow night, God willing. Okay, that's what they're supposed to do. Verse 27, they're told that this is a permanent rule. It's not just this Shabbos that you shouldn't go out and collect it, but all the subsequent seventh days, the other Shabboses, you're not supposed to collect it either. But hardly surprisingly, in verse 27, some of the people failed the test. This first Shabbos was supposed to be a test, as the Chumash spelled out earlier. And not surprisingly, some people didn't do it. The Chumash says, Yatsu min ha'am lilkot v'lo matza'u. On the seventh day, some of the people went out, a group of people went out to try to collect manna, and they didn't, were not able to find it. What is the response of Hashem when he discovers that the people are violating the laws of Shabbos? Hashem just told them, don't collect any manna. And the people are going out and violating what he asked. What's his response? So that's a good question. What would be your response if you were Hashem, so to speak, in confronting the first mass transgression, the Chilul Shabbos, among the Jewish people in the holy camp? So interestingly, what he gives them basically is what we would call nowadays a Musar Shmuz. He gives them a inspirational lecture to try to remind them of the greatness of the Shabbos, which they're now entitled to keep. And so, specifically, in verse 29, he turns to the Jews and he says, Ru'u, ki Hashem natan lachem ha-Shabbat. Look, Hashem has given you the Sabbath. Al kein hu natan lachem b'yom ha-shishi lechem yomayim. That's why he's given you on the sixth day a double portion of bread. Shavu, Ish tachtav, al yetze ish min kamo b'yom hashvi'i. Each one of you just stay home on the seventh day. You don't have to go anywhere on the seventh day. Life is good. Spend time with your family. You don't have to collect anything. You can stay home and relax. And you can have lovely meals. That seems to be what he's telling them. And if you think about it, it's sort of like an inspirational lecture. If you're introducing a large number of people to Shabbos nowadays, so you start off with the good stuff. You start off with Kiddush and with Chalent, and you start off with bread and with chicken and wine. You tell them all the good stuff, all the pleasant stuff about keeping Shabbos, and that's exactly how Hashem chooses to introduce the Jewish people to Shabbat here in the Chumash as well. Chazal pick up on the phrases here in verse 29, and they point out that Hashem says that God natan lachem ha-Shabbat. He has given you, the Jewish people, the Sabbath. And that is a striking phrase. The Orach HaShulchan, one of the great codifiers of the Halakha, in his introduction to the laws of Shabbat, picks up on this phrase, as well as its elaboration by Chazal, which referred to Shabbat as a matana tova yesh beveit gunazai, that I have a tremendous gift which I would like to give to you, O Jewish people, v'Shabbat Shema, and its name is the Sabbath. He wants to give it, v'ani chafetz litznach v'Yisrael, and I want to give it to the Jewish people. And the idea that the Sabbath is a gift is a profound idea. And the Orach HaShulchan, which I mentioned before, points out that if you stop to think about it, the basic idea of Shabbat, which is what we saw at the opening, which is the creation of the world, the commemoration that God created the world and rested on the seventh day, well, at that point, there were no Jews. In fact, there were only two people in the world. And frankly, the mitzvah of Shabbat should have been one which would apply to all people. All people are obligated to recognize that there's a God in the world. All people are to recognize that God created the world, He created it on the seventh day, and rested on that day. And it would have been entirely logical for Hashem to give the mitzvah of the Sabbath to all members of humanity. But here, Hashem has been silent about the idea of the Sabbath all until this point. It's been radio silence from the rest of the book of Bereshit and the first third of the book of Shemot here in the book of Exodus. It's been radio silence, and suddenly the Jewish people are gently being pulled into the observance of Shabbos, and Hashem turns them and says, I'm giving it to you. It's a present for you. It's a delightful thing. What an opportunity to be able to keep Shabbos, to rest. You used to be slaves. You were working for hundreds of years nonstop. You never got a break. And now you, a former bunch of slaves, are going to get to keep Shabbos. You're going to get to do these wonderful mitzvot that I give you. So there's a chiddush here. There's a piece of information, which is that the Jews are the ones who are going to be keeping the Shabbos, and not all other people of the world, even though that would have been quite reasonable. Chazal also, from these verses, derived the prohibitions of tchumin, the prohibition of wandering too far away from our home starting based on Shabbat, as well as the prohibition of hotza'ah, of carrying on Shabbos, of lifting things and walking around outside on Shabbat. This sort of kiruv shmuz, this kind of bring people close to the Torah and its mitzvot talk, works. And Hashem, apparently, when he gives a good talk to the people, knows what he's doing. And so the Chumash records for us in the next verse, at verse 30, V'yishpatu ha'am v'yom ha'shvi'i. And apparently, the next Shabbos, the people really kept it. The entire people, for that one Shabbos at least, did keep the entire second Shabbos, and they did as they were told. Apparently, Hashem's good and encouraging words landed and had their desired effect. At that point, the story of our parsha goes elsewhere and speaks about the rest of the story of the manna. I'd like to just to step back for a second and think about what this whole narrative seems to be suggesting. We saw Shabbos originally in the context of creation. And now, as I walk through the presentation of the Shabbos in this context, the context is a bunch of slaves, they're wandering in the desert, they're being introduced to Shabbos very slowly and gently in a very encouraging way. There's only positive commandments here. There's no sense of any prohibition to speak of other than going out to collect manna. There's no consequence other than a stern talking to, a stern lecture by Hashem for violating the laws of Shabbat. And we have an inspirational, delightful day of eating and being at home with one's family and the like. That whole idea is counterintuitive. These people at that time could very well have assumed that if we don't work today, if we don't get out there and collect our food, we're not going to have anything to eat. And apparently this first lesson of Shabbat is very simple. It's the lesson of bitachon, of having faith and confidence that God can provide for our needs in general, and even if we stop working on the Sabbath day. People in general, when they first contemplate the observance of Shabbat, are immediately confronted with what will happen with them in their parnasa if they no longer work on Friday nights and on Saturday. And a few generations ago in the United States and elsewhere in the world, being a Sabbath-observing Jew was a major sacrifice. People really lost their jobs every week when they wanted to keep Shabbos, and such stories are widely known of the fellow who gets hired on Sunday, and then he's fired on Friday when he leaves to go keep Shabbos, and he needs to find another job on Sunday. So the risk to one's livelihood, to one's ability to maintain one's family, is very real. And apparently the whole story here is to tell us the opposite message, that it's precisely by resting on Shabbos and by not going out to seek our living that God will sustain us throughout the week as well as on the Shabbos as well. That idea of having bitachon, faith in Hashem to provide, I'd like to share just very briefly a story from my experience in my previous shul, which I'm very fond of telling. The story revolves around a couple who actually were not members of my community per se. They lived in a nearby community, a tiny little itsy-bitsy Orthodox community that wasn't even barely on the map. And somehow or other I got to know them and we got to talking, and I spent much time talking to both the husband and the wife, newly observant Jews. And eventually I began to teach the laws of Shabbat to the husband. He would come once a week, once every other week, and we'd begin to review the laws of the prohibitions of Shabbos, the positive commandments of Shabbat, and specifically we spent a while on the issue of tchumin, the prohibition of wandering too far away from one's home on Shabbat. You can't walk too far on Shabbos, because it was quite relevant to him since the nearest synagogue was very far from his home. And as we were studying and studying, I found out that all of a sudden he told me that he had decided to stop working on Shabbos, even though he was a doctor. Even though he was entitled to be working on Shabbos, he decided that he was going to cut it out. And so I said to him, you don't have to do that. You're a doctor. We just can arrange for you to observe Shabbos as you're going about attending to your patients. And he said, no, I tried that. I'm done with it. I don't want to do it anymore. So he just dropped it, and with it, he lost a whole bunch of business. Then a little while later, I'm talking to them and getting to know them more, and a few months later I'm told, or shortly thereafter I'm told, I don't remember anymore how long, they tell me, we're moving. We're getting up and we're leaving our home. I'm dropping my entire medical practice. I'm moving to a new location, to a new community, where we can properly be integrated into a full Orthodox community, where we can observe Shabbat as it ought to be observed. And with that, he quit his jobs, they packed up, and they left their life behind, which they had previously known, including some of their children, who at that point were grown. They resettled into a new place. As I kept in touch with them, it was clear that they had no job set up for themselves in their new place. And I encouraged them, saying, it doesn't seem so responsible. You should find yourself a job. But they were undeterred in their bitachon, in their faith in God. And just a little while ago, I was talking to them, and he said, you know, Baruch Hashem, thank God, it all worked out. It doesn't always work out, but for them it did. My practice is now better than it ever was. I don't work even one bit on Shabbos anymore. And it was the best decision of our life to simply walk away from that whole way of doing things. It's an incredibly inspirational story to me. I'm constantly inspired when I think about it, and it's one which is, I think, an illustration of the bitachon, of the faith in God and His ability to provide, which is very much this opening story of Shabbat in this week's Parsha. I now want to keep on moving through the Tanakh and touch quickly on some of the other presentations of Shabbat as it appears elsewhere in the Chumash and elsewhere in the Tanakh. So we're going to move it at a higher clip, because this is principally a Parsha class, and I want to slow down the Parsha. But I'd like to touch on some of the other places as well. So skipping ahead a few chapters to chapter 20 of the book of Exodus, which is the presentation of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, in the book of Exodus, we encounter a tremendous divine sound and light show, which is Mamad Har Sinai, the revelation of God on Mount Sinai. It's an overwhelming spectacle for the people who are there. It is very intense. It is powerful. It is an inspirational and terrifying event, and there's much to be said about it, but right now all we need to know is that fact alone. And in the midst of this tremendous presentation, we read, his voice comes booming out, so to speak, and Moshe's voice comes booming out, and the Ten Commandments are read, and we read about, and the Jewish people are told the Ten Commandments, in particular the fourth of which is Zechor Et Yom HaShabbat, that they should remember the Sabbath day. They are told further on that they should work for 6 days and do kol melachtecha, all of their work, the malacha, which Hashem ceased doing at the first Shabbat, the beginning of the book of Bereshit, the beginning of the book of Genesis. That's what they have to stop doing. And the seventh day is going to be a Sabbath to the Lord. They can't do lo tasebo malacha, kol malacha. They can't do any malacha, any prohibited labor on that day, any of the members of their households, neither them nor their animals, because in 6 days God created the world, and on the seventh day he rests. Al kein beracha adonai et yom ha-shabbat v'yikadshehu. And therefore, echoing the original presentation of the idea of Shabbat, the day was sanctified and it was blessed by Hashem. And here we have the second time, but the most formal connection between that first Shabbat of God's creation and linking it into the Jewish people. Up until now, up until the first month or two when the Jews were in the desert, the Jews were observing kind of the positives of Shabbos. They were kind of being eased into it. Here they're told for the first time the prohibition of doing malacha. It's not well defined right here, but it's there. And additionally, they're told that observance links back to the original creation which we have. We apparently are still keeping that seven-day pattern which our ancestors started all that time ago. And this is the second appearance. Simply, the overall context is what I would call Gilui HaShchinah. It is the revelation of God's presence in this world. And that is the second of, or the third of the contexts. The first one was the creation of the universe, giving the Sabbath day disconnected from man a cosmic significance. The second context is the context of people, and the Jews in particular, receiving a gift of being able to depend upon God for their sustenance in the context of the story of the manna, the man. And here in this third context, the fourth of the Ten Commandments is basically giving us the message of an additional prohibition and the idea of Gilui Shechinah, that somehow or other that there's going to be a presence of God which is going to be made known to the Jews as they observe the Shabbos day. The fourth of the spots in the Chumash where Shabbat comes up again is in Parshat Ki Tisa. And for those of you who are following along with an actual text, you'll skip ahead to chapter 31 of the book of Exodus, Perek Lamed Aleph, and we'll begin together at verse 12. Here, Hashem renews the idea of Shabbat once again. He talks about it again, and he tells them to observe Shabbos, and now we have new information. At verse 13 we read, Ki oti venu veinechem ledortichem. It is a sign, an oat, between me and between you for all of your generations. It's somehow or other a mark of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. Ladaat ki ani Adonai mekadishchem. In order to know that I am the Lord who is the one who sanctifies you. That is the phrase that I would like to stop and think about for a moment, because it's not at all clear what that phrase means. What does it mean for the Shabbos to be a day which serves as an oath, as a sign, in order to know that I, the Lord, sanctify you? So the interpreters give a number of different ideas. The Ibn Ezra, Rashi suggests that the subject of the verb to know, which is not stated in the text of the Chumash, that the subject of that verb is non-Jews. The purpose of Shabbos is that non-Jews should know that the Jewish people are sanctified to God, and that idea remains true to this day. The sign of an observant and holy Jew is one who keeps the Shabbos. The basic way we refer to both from Jews and non-Jews, Gentiles, when we refer to Torah-observing Jews, we call them Shomer Shabbos Jews, Jews who observe the Sabbath. And throughout the history, from the Greeks on forward, and the Romans on forward, non-Jews have understood that the Sabbath is the mark of the Jew, and the Jew has been marked by the Sabbath. We have been killed for it, we have been mocked for it, we have been pointed out for it. Everyone knows that that's what Jews do. Another approach to understanding the verb lada'at, which has no subject, is to suggest that the subject is for the Jews, not the non-Jews, but the Jews should know that they are sanctified to Hashem. And the comments of Ibn Ezra point us in that direction as well. And I would like to suggest that, if you'll pardon my slight my ease of interpretation, that's not the word I'm looking for, my liberty of interpretation, I'd like to suggest that it's for the Jews to know, Ladat ki ani Hashem amikadishchem, that I am the one who sanctifies you. I am the one, Hashem says to the Jews, who is married to you. The Jewish people and Hashem are mikudeshet. Hashem is marrying the Jewish people, and the wedding ring is the Shabbos. It's the oath. It's the sign. It's the mark of the permanent connection b'nu v'nechem between the Jewish people and their father in heaven, their mother in heaven, whatever it is that brings them together as a single unit. And that is what they need to know, that it is Hashem who sanctifies them. Just like the Torah refers to marriage as kiddushin, as an act of sanctification. Hari at mekudeshet li, behold, you are sanctified to me, says the groom to the bride under the chuppah. So too, the idea of Shabbos here is one where the Jews are sanctified unto God in this way. To think of the Shabbos as being a sanctifying act, a sign of marriage, a sign of closeness, a sign of intimacy, is a powerful and resonant idea, and one which is quite rich. We go on and we talk about in subsequent Jewish history as the Shabbat Kala, as the Sabbath Bride, and the idea of Hashem and the Jewish people being married to each other is a major image of the entire text of the Tanakh. And the idea that Shabbos is what ties it all together is, I think, one of the important messages of this idea, of this passage. Going on, all of a sudden, the Chumash tells us additional new information. The new information here, going on at verse 31, chapter 31, verse 14, is not only is there a positive commandment to eat lechem mishneh and to enjoy the kiddush and to have some nice meals and be home and stay home, and not only is there a prohibition of Shabbos, which we've now learned as well, but now suddenly and dramatically the stakes have risen. What are the stakes? The stakes is that the Shabbos day is holy lechem, mechaleleha mot yumat. One who desecrates the holy Shabbos shall be put to death. And if they do it malacha that day, they do prohibited acts on that day, v'nichrotaha nefeshahi mekerev ameha, they'll be cut off from the people. They're no longer going to be a full standing member of the Jewish people. And at least in a different era, Chazal looked at Shabbat observance as being a very essence of what it meant to be a member of the Jewish people. And they used to say that Mechal Shabbos Pefarhesia is ka'akum. That if you publicly desecrate the Sabbath, it's as though you've lost your status as a Jew for at least some purposes in the law. We don't follow the full stringency of that idea nowadays because of the widespread non-observance of the Sabbath among our people. But the idea that the stakes got raised here, I think, is Not surprising. If suddenly you're getting married, it's no longer just a mitzvah that you're doing, like, let's say, putting tzitzis on your clothes, or let's say, putting a mezuzah on your door. But suddenly, there's a sense of mekadishchem. It's a sign binding the two parties together. Suddenly, it's not surprising that if it's a marriage, if people are getting together, then it's going to have the same punishment as all of the adulterous relationships which the Torah spells out. Karet. And the death penalty. It's not surprising that the level of the punishment rises with the level of intimacy which Hashem and the Jewish people have as a result of this intense and close relationship they have with one another. The final presentations of Shabbat in the Tanakh I would like to cover quickly. At this point, we've seen much material. We saw the original creation in Bereshit. We saw the presentation of Shabbos in Parsha B'Shalach, this week's Parsha, in the context of providing sustenance and providing faith for the Jews, easing them into this, easing this former slave nation into the idea of resting, that it's a mitzvah and a privilege to rest. We then stepped up to the idea of the Aseret HaDibrot, that we have to remember the Shabbos. It's going to bring Gilui Shechinah, it's going to bring God's presence into the world. And now we've just seen again in Parsha Ki Tisa the idea that it's like a wedding ring. It's a sign for Jews and for non-Jews to know that the Jewish people and Hashem are married. The wedding ring is the Sabbath, and one who desecrates it, one who stomps on the wedding ring, one who violates the vows, so to speak, is going to be subject to the full punishment of an adulterer in the eyes of the halacha. Chazal talk about a non-Jew who observes Shabbos, and they try to figure out why that is to be frowned upon. And one of the ideas that's presented in the Talmud is that non-Jews are essentially transgressing the intimacy of Hashem and the Jewish people. So what does that mean? I don't have intimacy with God because I don't eat milk and meat. But Shabbos is different. There's an implied marital contract there. And if someone else comes in, they're adulterers. They're wandering into a relationship that doesn't belong. And as a result, they are formally prohibited by the halacha from observing Shabbos, a halacha which is well known to those who are in the midst of conversion even today. The next, don't turn the page anymore, because you'll spend more time turning than it's worth for right now. there are a few more presentations of Shabbat in the context of all of the holidays. The next point, when the narrative picks up Shabbos, is very brief. It's towards the end of Parshat Shlach in the book of Numbers, at the end of chapter 15. And very simply, a single Jew is found gathering sticks on the Sabbath day, the Mekoshesh Eitzim, and he is brought forth and is punished by the entire congregation. Simply put, the premise of that episode is very simple, that in general the Jews were in fact keeping Shabbos. And in general, what used to be get a little lecture back in Parsha B'Shalach, that's which got a little slap on the hand. Hashem gave them a lecture for violating the first Shabbos when they went out to collect the manna that they weren't supposed to. Here he went out to collect some sticks, and instead of getting a little lecture, he's actually punished and put to death. The first time, you couldn't possibly have such a firm punishment because it was inappropriate. You have to encourage people first before you give them such a sharp slap. But additionally, also, en onshin ela im ken matirin. You can't possibly punish people harshly unless you give them a warning first. And here, the Jews have been given a strong warning repeatedly about the prohibitions of Shabbos, as well as the punishments which arise from the marital nature of that relationship. And as a result, this first Sabbath violator that we hear about is put to death for what seems like a technical violation, a small matter. Again, the issue of carrying and moving things around outside, which is the main area of prohibition which the Chumash has spelled out. I'd like to touch upon two final presentations. Only those of you with the Tanakh will be able to follow along. If you have a full Tanakh and you can quickly find your way to chapter 56 of the book of Isaiah, you will encounter a passage which is familiar to those who hear the Haftarah on fast days in Shul. Here, the Navi, the prophet Isaiah, is giving uplifting speech to the Jewish people, encouraging them to seek out God and that God is to be available to them and known to them. And he tells the Jewish people very simply that no matter how far you might be away, even if you are a saris, someone who is incapable of reproducing, someone who's going to have no children, you might become desperate and feel that you're divided away from God and his people. That's what the Navi says, that's what the prophet says. And so the Jewish people are told that they should be careful to keep the Shabbos and not desecrate it, and not to do anything bad in this world. And they're told that when they do those things, that in verse 5, "V'natati lahem v'veiti v'chomotai Yad Vashem," they're going to be given a Yad Vashem. That's the name of a Holocaust museum in Jerusalem nowadays, Yad Vashem. But here, in the context of Shabbos observance, what it means is they're going to be given a permanent remembrance, so to speak, before God. They're going to be given a Shem Olam Eten Lo. It's even better than having kids. It's going to be a permanent divine reputation before God, which they're going to be given. And what will happen if they do it correctly is V'havyotim El Har Kadshi V'Samachtim Veit Tfilati, that God will bring them to his holy mountain and cause them to rejoice in his house of prayer. And this idea that Hashem is going to bring the Jews to his house of prayer reflects the last of the ideas in the Chumash, which I didn't have time for this evening, which talks about the idea of Shabbat in the context of the Mishkan. In Parshat Vayakel, and later on, back in the book of Shmot, my apologies for skipping over this, the Chumash presents the idea of the prohibition of Malacha and Shabbat again in the context of the Mishkan, in the context of the Holy Tabernacle in the desert, and again points out the importance of Shabbos observance, the extreme punishment for doing so, and thereby creates a better definition of what Malacha, of what prohibited activity is going to be on Shabbos. Namely, those things, as Chazal explained it, which were done to create the Mishkan, to bring God's presence down into the world in the holy tabernacle in the desert, it's precisely those things which we must refrain from on Shabbos. So the idea that the connection between Mishkan and Shabbat here is simply that Shabbos brings God into the world, the Mishkan brings God into the world, and so there's an intimate connection between the holiest place of God's presence, the tabernacle, or the synagogue nowadays, and the Shabbos as well. And so returning back to where I was in the book of Isaiah, we are told that when you observe Shabbos correctly, you'll be brought into the Beit HaMikdash. You'll be brought into Hashem's house and enjoy and celebrate and delight in God's presence there. Again, that theme of God's revelation, his presence, his closeness, his intimacy, all those ideas. The last prominent place and the last context of Shabbat in the Tanakh, which I would like to share with you tonight, and there are others as well, is taken from the book of Yirmiyahu, the book of Jeremiah. In the 17th chapter thereof, the last section of chapter 17 of the book of Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, the prophet is excoriating the Jews for various things which they have done wrong. And suddenly, although his main focus has been on Avodah Zarah, idol worship on the one hand, as well as a whole slew of interpersonal failings on the other hand, that's been his main focus, suddenly here, there's an extended passage where the prophet Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, speaks with impassioned terms about Shabbos observance. Not as an individual, as Isaiah had done, not that if you, a lowly individual, will keep the Shabbos, I will bring you, an individual, into my holy home and bring you close to me, says God. No, here he's talking about the entirety of the Jewish people, and Yirmiyahu fixes himself in most public place on Har HaBayit, on the Temple Mount, and God instructs him to go there, where everyone is going to see, where the kings come and where the people go, where everyone comes and goes, and I want you to give the following message, and the message is very simple. Don't carry things around on Shabbos. As it says in verse 21, Hishamru benafshotechem, be very careful with your souls, v'al tisu masach b'yam ha-shabbat, v'haveitem b'sha'arei Yerushalayim. No carrying things around on Shabbos. No carrying around burdens on Shabbos. V'chol malacha lo ta'asu v'kidashtem et yom ha-shabbat. No malacha on Shabbos. You've got to sanctify the Shabbos day. And if you'll do that, then at verse 25, we have an incredible promise. The Jews are going to be told that kings and princes are going to come and sit on the throne of David if the Jews and the entire kings and everybody observes Shabbos and doesn't carry things and doesn't do malacha, prohibited activity, and does sanctify the day. And similarly, sadly, if they don't, at the end of the chapter, at verse 27, if they don't sanctify the day, and they do carry things around, and they do things that they're not supposed to do, then very startlingly, v'hitzati esh v'sha'areha v'achla armanot Yerushalayim v'lo tichbeh. The Navi tells us that Hashem will light on fire the gates of Jerusalem, and it will be on fire and will never be put out. In short, he's threatening destruction of the Jewish people over the observance of Shabbos. How far have we come from the original simple presentation of the cosmic Shabbos at the very beginning of the Chumash? Or the simple, let's have some nice challah and shalint and stay home and be with the family presentation, the Musar Shmuz, the Kiruv message which we found in Parsha Bishalach. We've come from there, we've come to the idea of the marriage ceremony of Lada'at Ki Ani Hashem Yikadishchem. We've seen how Shabbos connects to the Mishkan and the Gilui Shechina, God's presence in the world. We've come to a definition of malacha, of prohibited activity on Shabbos. From that context, we've come to the book of Isaiah, promising people that this is how they can come close to God, even if they are childless, even if they feel alone in the world. I'll treasure your personal observance of Shabbos, even if you're all alone. And similarly, we finally come here to the book of Jeremiah, and say the entire faith of the Jewish people rests on the observance of Shabbos. With it, without it, there'll be destruction. And with it, kings will reign. Everything will be great and as good as possible. The Tanakh, the Bible, has an incredible picture for us in this whole story, and it is that which I wanted to share with you this evening. I hope that we learned something together, and now I'm perfectly content to listen to people's questions. The first question I received here is from one of our participants named Neil, and he was asking a few minutes ago about the issue of Goy Shabbat v'Shabbat Chayiv Mitah, that a non-Jewish person, the Talmud says, who observes the Shabbos is to be punished. And he asks very simply, the most basic question, wait a second, he asks me, the whole point is that non-Jews should also know that God created the world, which is certainly one of the ideas that I shared. Why is it such a bad thing if they also do it? And what's important is that they're supposed to know that there's a God, and that God created the world, but they're also supposed to recognize the unique role of the Jewish people in conveying that message. And the Shabbos, as I tried to emphasize, was given only to the Jews. Ra'u ki Hashem natan lachem et haShabbat, that it's Hashem who gave you, only the Jews, the Shabbos. That's part of what was the wedding ring, so to speak, between the intimacy and the sanctity of the Jewish people and their exalted status, and their connected. And so it seems to me that they're supposed to recognize God as the Creator, recognize the sanctity of the Jewish people and their observances. But if they'd like to get in on the marriage, if they want to be part of that intimate connection, then they'll have to join up with the Jewish people and be sanctified with the holiness of Kedushat Yisrael, of the sanctity of the Jewish people, so they can come close to the Holy One, blessed be He, Himself. I don't know whether that answered the question to Neil's satisfaction, but I think that's part of the idea that I wanted to share. Are there any other questions? I think that's better now. Can you hear me now? Okay. I think people should be able to hear me now. My apologies. The question that I was asked okay, so you've explained to me why they shouldn't observe Shabbos, but he wants to know, can they reach a closeness to God without Kedushat Yisrael? So that's an important question. It's no longer connected per se to Shabbos. I would just like to share with you a famous passage from the Rambam at the end of Hilchot Shemitah V'Yovel, where he talks about this issue of coming close to God. And he very expressly states, and it's the entire faith of our people is rooted in this, that you don't have to be Jewish. We discourage people from converting because we believe that it's entirely possible to have a close spiritual connection to God, even if one is not a member of the Jewish people. If you want to have the full sanctified relationship of the Jewish people with God, you're going to have to step up to all the responsibilities that that entails. But for ordinary people who are created in the image of God, simply following the Shiva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the seven Noahide laws, is what they need to do. And with that, the Rambam writes very simply that they can reach exceptionally exalted levels of closeness to God if they put their mind to it. And we know indeed that there are indeed very holy and connected and spiritual people who are non-Jews and who are profoundly connected to God. And so not only can they, but they do. And I hope that more and more will do that as well. Any other questions? Okay, Neil seems satisfied with that answer. I got a cool Yesher Kalach from him. And I don't see any other questions coming in, so I'll stay here for one more moment, and then I will sign off. I hope everyone has a great Shabbos, and that it's uplifted with all these different perspectives that I shared with you.